Chapter 5 Flight. I only dated two boys who were my age in high school. The first was the golden-haired boy who was my first kiss in preschool. We had gone to separate elementary and middle schools, but we ended up running into each other eventually. He was a scene kid in a screamo band and had gotten into the habit of straightening his hair. We met at a mutual friend's bar mitzvah. I was very into photography at the time and took my camera everywhere. I took a bunch of photos of him, and I think he liked the attention. It was only later, chatting on IM, that we realized we had gone to the same preschool. I asked for a photo of him when he was little, and there he was, my first kiss. I don't think I told him. I always deny being a romantic, but now whenever I tell this story, my friends laugh at me. He told me his dream was to be a psychologist, to move to the suburbs and have a family. I was shocked that he didn't want to stay in the city, or even if he wanted to leave, that it wasn't at least for any other city. I had a massive crush on him, but even at the time, I knew it wasn't going to last. Still, I wanted the first penis in my vagina to be his. I had plenty of experience with women by that point, but still hadn't done PIV with a guy. I think he was more anxious about my virginity than I was. I knew he had had sex before, so I was expecting him to sort of take the lead. He was very sweet, but had a hard time putting on the condom, a hard time getting his cock inside me, and I had no idea what I was doing, so I was of little help. I still smile when I think about us fumbling around. My other boyfriend was in my art program. His work was beautiful and intense. He had dark hair and dark eyes and was very into jiu-jitsu and football, but he was so gentle. I had certainly not seen myself falling for a jock, but he wasn't really a jock. He was quiet and studious with a dark sense of humor. I was glad that I was in the art program. Things ended poorly with him, as high school romances often do, with drama that I barely remember anymore. But that art program was where I finally met people my age who weren't too weirded out by me. My senior year, my cluster headaches became particularly awful and I became deeply suicidal. I would usually just skip all my other classes and just hang out in the art studio working on my oil paintings. My senior art studio teacher, bless his heart, never ratted me out or told me I had to leave. I would just do everything I could to put everything I was feeling on the canvas. While I was painting, I could just be. Just see the things in front of me for what they were and capture them as best I could. There was no pressure to perform for anyone else. Just looking at my piece, then my reference, stepping back, and starting again. As I grew and began reconsidering my beliefs about the role and place of women, I realized my views on sex work were poorly informed. I started devouring all the information I could about sex workers. There was so much incredible theory I was able to discover online. It was not the sort of thing anyone at my relatively conservative high school was discussing, but I discovered there were pro-sex work texts being written millennia ago. I started writing about it for my art class essays. I was transfixed by the idea that women could reclaim the power taken from them via the patriarchy by owning their own sexual power. I took a great deal of selfies as a part of my work for this class. I'd been taking photos of myself for a long time by that point. I remember being quite young, maybe 3 or 4, and watching my mother take photos using a disposable camera. I asked to use it. I took a photo of the sky, which I thought was very beautiful. "Don't waste the film," my mother scolded me. I loved taking photos. There was something so thrilling about being able to capture an image. I was so in love with being alive, I wanted to grab all of it and record it. I loved the thrill of waiting for the prints to come back from the lab. I would hold up the negatives to the light as my father explained to me how the chemical reactions allowed us to capture the light of a particular moment. I occasionally turned the camera back on myself. I had no tripod, no fancy camera with a timer, and I was too young to figure out any of that anyways. I took photos of my face. I was too short to see myself in the bathroom mirror, so one of the only ways I could look at myself was through photos. Of course, the first few selfies. Are they selfies if they're handheld, only with a film camera? looked strange, my face distorted by the close range. When I was in high school, my parents gifted me a digital camera. I was incredibly excited. How cool to be able to iterate on photos so quickly, to be able to see how they came out. I'd plug the camera into my computer, downloading all the photos, meticulously archiving them into carefully sorted folders. I took photos of my dog, my friends, my family, of plants I liked. I took self-portraits obsessively. At that point, I also had a laptop with a webcam and, eventually, a phone with a camera as well. I used every camera I had to take photos of myself. I would hold out my hand or use a tripod and a timer. I posted everything on social media. In the beginning, when I was posting them, I don't think there was even a word for selfie. At the time, the term was GPOY, gratuitous picture of yourself, and the gratuitous part was really felt. I would pretend to be ironic, posting them, pretending I was a vain girl obsessed with my image. But of course, I knew by posting them, I was still performing the act of being a vain girl. The self-deprecation was meant as a shield against criticism. Girls are taught early that being too obsessed with our appearance is a sin. As I was in this art program, constant self-portraits didn't particularly disturb anyone I knew IRL. To be honest, I'm not really sure anyone cared, besides the few guys at school who thought I was hot. As I started reading more art theory, I began writing a paper about women, vanity, self-portraits, and social media. I was becoming quite active online, boldly connecting with anyone whose thoughts interested me and messaging them. Some people were amused to talk with a child. Some people pushed my boundaries. When I was young, my parents had warned me that there were creepy older men out there who tried to take advantage of me. I foolishly believed I was smart and worldly enough to be able to tell if anyone was trying to pull anything like that. For the most part, I was able to tell when older men were being gross online. For better or for worse, I did as I pleased. I was a part of AltLit, a writing community that was exploring literary minimalism. As with most writing circles, there were certainly older men who loved the idea of access to all these young and eager teenage girls. Most of them were obviously awful, like Jeremy Lin, who wrote an entire novel based on an abusive relationship he had with a 16-year-old. I enjoyed the thrill of hanging out with him and his sexual attention, so I made a grotesque game of it. I would find an older literary man online, add him on Facebook, lead them on, let them think that I would fuck them, then disappoint them. After Jeremy Lin, I turned my attention to Steve Rogenbuck. We flirted. I had made my Facebook look like I might be a young NYU student, but he thought I was far younger. He told me that he thought it would be fine to have sex with a girl who was 15, as long as they were consenting. I was disgusted. To me, if a man pursued me thinking I was 18 or 19, they were maybe a little creepy, but not too gross. Steve thought I was younger than I actually even was and clearly got off on it. It made his poetry about dead girls rotting in the forest take on an even darker tint. The way my future wife, Anna, groomed me was even more insidious. We became Facebook friends when she was in her late 20s and I was underage. She was lightly flirtatious, but nothing over the top. She acted kind and nurturing, helping me out with an art project I was working on for high school. I began writing for her art blog, and she said she would mentor me. I totally had a crush. One day, she commented on one of my photos, "You look so young." It made me feel nauseous, uncomfortable, for a reason I couldn't quite put my finger on. I didn't want her to see me as young. I remember walking with a friend who had just started her sophomore year at Pratt to MoMA PS1 for an exhibition that looked interesting. It was a video installation of some kind, dark and drony, violent feminist stuff. Anna came up in conversation, and I gushed about how lucky I felt to have her support, how cute she and her fiancé were. My friend and I agreed. There are cool art parents. One man, a minor poet who ran a small but popular press, more overt in his creepy ways, repeatedly asked me out on dates. I finally agreed and dragged along one of my friends from high school, who annoyed the creep endlessly. I still laugh when I remember the three of us walking around McCarran Park, him trying to figure out how to ditch my friend, me pretending to be oblivious. Men like this love to prey on young and inexperienced women. For so long, having been brought up on media glamorizing the relationships between young women and older men, I bought into the idea that an older man would be a better match, that young women were naturally mature, that younger men weren't worth wasting your time on. The first time I heard someone counter that idea was in high school. A girl standing at the locker beside me mentioned to her friend that an older guy had messaged her on Instagram. "Gross," she said. "He's so old and creepy." I remember being shocked, having been trained to be flattered by the attention of older men. It's true, though. Older men are mega creepy for trying to date teenagers. Being older myself, I can't imagine wanting to date a teen. Honestly, they're obnoxious, they're loud, they're desperate for approval in a way that is grating to be around. For an older person who wants to date someone they can manipulate, however, that desperation is quite appealing. Men hunting for prey often set themselves up as gatekeepers in some way, like running some small literary press, a gallery, etc. Often, it is a pursuit that earns them little to no money. What they're interested in is not wealth, but prestige. Once they have created a glamorous image, respect from their peers, they initiate relationships with much younger women, telling them they're mature, special, talented, that they don't usually go for someone so young, but... Looking back, I was so eager to see myself as smart, savvy, and experienced that letting myself see that I was being taken advantage of would have been a devastating blow to my ego. It's a catch-22. In order to escape the grasp of these creepy men, you need to be mature enough to admit that you are too immature to handle a relationship with someone a decade older than you. For the most part, I tried to avoid hanging out with the kids who went to my high school or any adjacent social scene. I didn't want to date them, and I didn't want to be involved in their petty drama. Everyone, besides a few friends I told about my little dalliances, thought I was an absolute prude. Sometimes the obnoxious and preppy boys would attempt to flirt with me, as a joke, and I would roll my eyes. I saved my naughtiness for Brooklyn. At the time, I had an internship in the garment district, designing clothing, so it was easy enough for me to tell my parents that I was working late, getting dinner with my boss, or staying over at a friend's place. Instead, I would go to a mixed film festival, a poetry reading in a loft, or a gallery show deep in Bushwick. As I worked on my art practice in high school and started talking more about critical theory and feminist art on social media, I fell in with a group of much older women artists. It was exciting, hanging out with a bunch of cool girls who had just finished their MFAs and were starting to be taken more seriously by the art world. I went to a friend's exhibition at the new museum, feeling like I was beginning to find a place of belonging. The word for selfie was starting to be used more. The Kardashians were gaining in popularity. People were skewering selfies and op-eds, claiming it was foolish teenage girls being vain and self-obsessed. Selfies were destroying the youth, or they were too sexual, or they were preventing people from reading. Whatever. I was infuriated. I released a piece I was very excited about, something exploring self-portraits, narcissism, and women. That year, selfie was the Oxford Dictionary's word of the year. The New York Times started writing about selfies as a serious art form. It was cool to see people finally take selfies more seriously. Just annoying that they were still not acknowledging the hard work all we teenage girls had put into making selfies a serious art form. I went to a college in New York after I graduated. I wanted to stay where the excitement was. I was lucky when going to college and received a really generous scholarship. I had a blast. I had never been surrounded by people who were excited, absolute nerds like me. I would wake up around 11, have late breakfast in the dining hall, head to class, get lunch with my classmates and discuss Derrida, or debate what the best tabletop RPG was, or sit by myself with a massive bowl of food and shovel it into my mouth while reading whatever obscure text my professor had recommended to me that month. I'd then pull out my laptop and start typing until it was dark out, working on the long essays that were assigned for each of my classes. Once it was dark, I'd head back to my dorm room. I'd either catch up on some reading, or my dorm mates and I would host a party. We soon became known for being the lesbian dorm room, and girls would often show up extremely drunk, wanting to try out having sex with a girl for the first time. I vividly remember trying to work on an essay whose due date was rapidly approaching. My roommate knocked on the door, asking if I wanted to join in on the orgy in the living room. I shook my head. Next time. Around this time, I started my long-distance relationship with Anna. Soon after I turned 18 and went off to college, she started sending me overtly sexual messages. She was 27, almost a full decade older than me, but I felt like I was mature and I could handle it. I had studied feminism and thought I knew most of what there was to know about navigating any sort of weird power dynamics that arose. People online criticized our relationship, saying it was creepy for her to date me, but I ignored them. One month, she visited from California and asked to meet up in person. I agreed. I remember thinking I didn't want to do anything sexual with her, at least not our first night hanging out. When we met in person, she told me I looked really young and said she had been concerned when I told her I was 18 that I wouldn't be mature enough to date. It was the perfect neg. I felt incredible anxiety. I wanted to show that I was mature. We walked around for an hour or two talking. I suggested we go to a hotel. She spent a long time looking for the least expensive room nearby. Then she took me there and kissed me. Then she started rearranging the entire room, complaining that the lighting was bad, shoving the bed up against a different wall. She asked if it was okay for her to go down on me. I said yes, but I didn't want it. She started fingering me. It was incredibly painful. She was trying to put as many fingers inside of me as she could. She asked if she could at least try to fist me. I said sure. I bit my tongue and tried to moan like it was pleasurable. She seemed to believe it. She came 6 times that night. We had sex for 6 hours, and then I fell asleep. I woke up beside her in the hotel room, the sheets covered in bloody handprints. I had been on my period. She said she liked that. I considered whether I'd been taken advantage of. I decided that I suggested it and that I liked her. The sex was painful, but I thought that perhaps that was the price of being loved. Plus, wasn't it a bit exciting? I didn't tell her the sex hurt until years later. There was a period where we had sex every day, often at least 3 times a day, sometimes up to 7. It always hurt. I would initiate because I believed I had to, that it was my job, the work I had to do to be loved. I spent my winter vacation with her. It went by like a dream. She got me an internship at a prestigious tech nonprofit in San Francisco where she lived. She was too loving, treating me to dinner every night, showering me with compliments, covering her Facebook feed in sweet and darling posts talking about our time together. I felt adored. There were strange moments that didn't fit in with the rest. I went with her to Berkeley to attend a lecture about Indonesian art that had piqued my interest. On the way home, I was talking excitedly about the lecture, about how I really loved the intricate details of the shadow puppetry, especially. She slapped me across the face, hard, in the middle of the street, and stared at me with a strange look in her eye. Then she began laughing. I started crying. "Why did you do that?" I asked. "Don't ever do that to me again." She told me she had thought it would be funny and apologized profusely. I don't know what got into me. It is a moment that disturbed me throughout the relationship. I tried hard to contextualize it, to smooth it over in the narrative of our relationship. But sometimes I would lie awake at night and wonder, why did she do that? You might wonder why I stayed. A large part was because I was young and naive, and Anna was good at rationalizing away all of my concerns. I'm not perfect either, I would think. And there was the cognitive dissonance too. She was so, so loving most of the time. The other moments, the moments where she scared me, I tucked away, telling myself they were just strange outliers. One day, we were lying in bed, and Anna asked me something about how birds migrate. "How should I know? Why don't you Google it?" I said, annoyed. "Half the time you know these things anyways," she said, pulling out her phone. I shrugged. "You know, sometimes I feel like you're a Russian spy or something. Why do you know about all these things? I imagine you were raised in some boot camp, trained, and then had your brain wiped, like a sleeper agent." "Okay," I said. After I went back to college, my health issues began to flare up. At one point, I was so sick I could hardly move. My roommate dragged me to the school's health clinic. A nurse swabbed the back of my throat, and it came out black and lumpy. She made a face and said, "Oh, you're sick." My professors were upset I hadn't emailed to say I wouldn't be coming to class. I tried to tell them I had been too sick. They told me I couldn't have been too sick to write an email. I was distraught and showed the email to my roommate, who laughed. "I basically had to force you to eat and drink water." At the beginning of school, I had seriously considered a career as an academic. After this incident, though, I was concerned. I was trying to get to a point where I was completely financially independent and realized most of the students around me were either taking on massive amounts of student debt or their parents were taking care of them. I heard whispers that the school was considering reducing the amount of scholarships they disbursed due to budget cuts. And of course, the scholarship I was receiving was completely dependent on my ability to maintain performance in my classes. It becomes hard to focus on crafting complex theoretical essays when you are concerned about whether you will be able to make enough money. I was extremely frugal during my time in school. When I would treat myself to eating out, I would make the leftovers stretch for days. I would go to the dining hall and try to stay as long as possible, make two meals out of one dining hall credit. I would buy dry groceries in bulk and try to cook as many of my meals as I could. I had a credit card I paid off every month to try to build my credit, just in case. I probably could have let my parents pay for my expenses and been more comfortable financially. But my parents had made homophobic remarks over the years, and I knew kids who had been suddenly cut off financially after their parents discovered they were queer. I was scared that if they knew and decided to disown me, I would starve or become homeless. This was not a baseless fear. I had multiple friends who struggled for a long time after their parents disowned them for being gay. I was terrified of the same thing happening to me. All this anxiety caused a major flare-up in my cluster headaches. I didn't want to be afraid anymore. I started taking more computer science classes. While academia felt more intellectually appealing, a tech job seemed like it was more financially stable. At the time, I still idealized tech as an industry that was incredibly meritocratic. There was such a high demand for engineers that if you could program, you were basically guaranteed a job with high security, and certainly you would be treated well. That would be the only way to run a successful company, right? After my second semester, Anna convinced me to drop out of college, and I headed to San Francisco to work at a startup. I was able to walk from our home in the Mission to my office. San Francisco was never too cold, and it was always a pleasant 20 minutes. Within a month of moving to San Francisco, Anna and I started couples therapy. We hadn't really had any fights yet, but we both thought of ourselves as pretty crazy and figured it wouldn't hurt. I was firm about my desire to be in an open relationship. I was young and queer, and I'd already had enough orgies to know that I didn't want to stop having them anytime soon. Anna had never been in an open relationship, and she had been cheated on in one of her previous relationships. She said she would think about it. San Francisco has for a long time been a hotbed of polyamory, complicated queer and kinky families. Dossie Easton, one of the premier writers on the subject of polyamory, happened to have an office in San Francisco, and we decided to see a therapist that was interning under her. Our therapist was just my type. An older woman with her hair always restrained in a tight updo or a braid, with a uniform of black A-line dresses, sheer stockings, and 5-inch heels. I just knew she had to be a retired former dominatrix. Privately, despite Anna's disapproval, I was crushing. She was incredible, recommending us endless resources on polyamory, explaining different relationship structures, reassuring Anna that plenty of people were able to be in sustainably open relationships. Because we didn't have any immediate issues to deal with, we went every other week. I always looked forward to every session. At first, the relationship was as idyllic as I thought possible. In contrast to my hypercritical and angry parents, Anna was gentle, helpful, kind. We watched movies together on a projector screen she had set up in her bedroom, had brunch in the park near our place. We had a fantastic intellectual connection, and it felt like we could talk endlessly about everything. She could always finish my sentences. I spilled water once near her desk and had a panic attack, worried she would punish me for being careless. Instead, she rubbed my back and told me it was fine. I hadn't spilled it anywhere near the computer, and she knew I wouldn't make the same mistake again. Anna believed me when I said I had cluster headaches. When my parents and my psychiatrist had called me crazy, I had begun to believe them. On some level, I truly felt I was deluding myself into being in pain, trusting that I was experiencing actual pain caused not by psychosomatic delusion, but by a preventable physical mechanism was the key to my healing. One cannot seek treatment if one denies the root of the disease. Once I finally accepted my cluster headaches, I needed to actually treat myself. There is no cure, only preventatives and palliatives. LSD is one such preventative. For a few months, I told Anna I didn't want to do any drugs, not even weed, because my grandmother was a bit crazy and I didn't want to trigger that within myself. What if I awakened something terrible? She put two tabs of acid in my hand and told me to take them, told me she would guide me through the trip and teach me some sort of secret about existence. At first, we were giggly and playful. She brought out paper and art supplies so we could draw. But I was more interested in talking and introspecting. "You know," I said, "I don't particularly feel like I'm tripping. More like my regular thought patterns are enhanced. I often think in this circular style anyways. I just feel more me." We had sex and she kept criticizing me, telling me that I wasn't doing it right, so I asked to stop. She didn't want to stop until she made me come, so I faked an orgasm. Then she told me that I was like a bad boyfriend who only cared about his pleasure and wouldn't ever care to get his girlfriend off. Then she started talking about God. "God is the joke," she said. "What do you mean?" I asked. "God is the joke?" "Life is the joke, and God is the joke. Do you get it?" I did not, but I was game to try and inhabit that mindset, the mindset of God being the joke. Later, when we were hanging out with friends, I made reference to Anna thinking God was the joke. Her face twisted, and she grabbed my wrist and told me not to speak of it again. After doing acid, thankfully I did not experience any sort of schizophrenia or any other mental aberrations. Many people I know need to take the next day slow after doing acid. They feel strange, not quite sick, more like they have just gotten over the flu and are readjusting. After doing acid, I feel balanced, calm, and deeply secure. My brain defragmented like a computer hard drive. My sleep is deeper, and I wake up in the morning feeling refreshed. Anna seemed surprised that I wasn't acting more manic. She had been diagnosed as being bipolar, so was very attached to the idea of me being bipolar as well. She said that was what made our connection so powerful. I like to joke that LSD simply makes me more like myself. I am already intensely self-aware, constantly probing and weighing everything. For me, a high dose of LSD intensified that. Our second trip together, I looked at Anna, who seemed to me to be a fairy. Her skin was a light pink, all of her pores slightly darker and shimmering. Her hair had green undertones. Beautiful. I didn't want to have sex during the trip, but I didn't tell her this. She was soon on top of me, and suddenly she appeared to me to be a demon. Her skin was purple now, the lines of her face intensified. "Let me inside you," she said, pressing against me. Tripping, I thought she was a demon asking to possess me. I thought about how vampires need to ask permission before they can cross a threshold. I tried to find a way to say no, but I spread my legs for her. I trusted Anna with my life. One day, I had taken lithium right before I took my dose of LSD. The trip seemed more intense than previous ones, off-kilter somehow. She live-streamed the first few minutes of the trip. I remember an internet friend saying, "Have fun, kids." We played a video game and I could barely see the screen. Then I was gone. Instead, there was an incredible circle of light. Everything became incredibly complex, tiny, self-aware, then less so, large and sprawling. I was in the circle, simply dissolved into it, with all things, beautiful and equally present in everything, growing into the fractal pattern, curling in upon everything else, and then back out. I awoke in the hospital, ego reconsolidated, Anna standing over me, crying. "That was so beautiful," I said, filled with a deep and utter calm. Suddenly, my mother was on the phone, and I reassured her that I was fine. My hospital gown was a smooth cotton. I couldn't stop talking about my ego-death experience. The only thing I could compare it to was The World, a poem by Henry Vaughan. I saw eternity the other night, like a ring of pure and endless light, all calm as it was bright, and round beneath it, time in hours, days, years, driven by the spheres, like a vast shadow moved, in which the world and all her train were hurled. Yet some, who all this while did weep and sing and weep, soared up into the ring, but most would use no wing. "O fool," said I, "thus to prefer dark night before true light, to live in grots and caves and hate the day, because it shews the way from which this dead and dark abode leads up to God, a way where you might tread the sun and be more bright than he." I still think about that place. I had never feared death, but after experiencing dying in that way, some part of me longs to go back. I have thought so long about why we must be separated from each other. Why must I be self and you be other? I think, ultimately, love can reach its truest form only if there is an other. The universe, if it were to remain a muck of pure energy, could not hold itself. Being separated from God or love or the universe or whatever else you might call it is our earliest trauma. I think this is why time in the womb is so important. Someone once told me that cats and dogs remember their time in the womb, that they are developed to the point of being able to have memories, and that that is why humans are always longing in a way that animals, perhaps, are not. We are born too soon, and unless our mothers cared for us perfectly, there is always that immense trauma of being helpless and uncared for. I think our consciousnesses are separated so that we might appreciate the beauty of each other and see the beauty of ourselves reflected back. The image I have of independence, of a man in a log cabin he built with his hands, perhaps with a dog, who hunts for his food in the woods, seems nearly impossible these days. How many people still live like that? Our lives are so intertwined, our roles so specialized. I have a doctor who treats my head, another who treats my heart. I think of how capitalism facilitates this, how money flows through one hand to the next. Whoever controls the flow of capital can become a minor god who must receive offerings to be placated. What happens when you restrict or prevent the flow of capital to segments of the population? To women, to people of color, specifically Black and Indigenous peoples. Some people say money allows independence. People call themselves financially independent or allow themselves to believe the money they have somehow shields them from disaster. In the past, wealth did not necessarily refer to millions of digital dollars sitting in a bank somewhere, but usually a stockpiling of slow perishing grain, rice or wheat. In times of famine or other lack, those with wealth, who carefully saved, could feed themselves, their family, and their community. The incentives of capitalism prey on those same instincts to gather materials to ensure future prosperity. The mechanisms of exploitation are now distanced from the mechanisms of acquiring vast amounts of capital. One can accumulate millions of dollars while sitting at a computer in their home, trading stocks, living in a way many would consider non-harmful to others. One can barely scrape by on the income of a Starbucks manager, earning enough for a Netflix subscription, rent, student loans, and perhaps a few creature comforts throughout the month. Yet the Starbucks manager is required by the job to enact violence of a kind on the employees they manage, pressuring them to come to work while sick, asking them to ignore the petty cruelties inflicted by the customers. Perhaps the hypothetical stock trader even comes to visit this coffee shop, buying a fair trade latte, tipping 100%. They do not directly hold Starbucks stock, but it is a part of an ETF they hold in their portfolio. When value is extracted from the Starbucks employee, it goes into their bank account. They profit more from the exploitation than the manager, yet they can remain blissfully unaware of and removed from the mental anguish that they profit from. When the sole profiteer of your anguish is your boss, the owner of the factory at which you work, it is easy to direct your ire, to demand better treatment, to strike. When the ownership is obfuscated and the manager is almost as oppressed as you are, it becomes more challenging. After 3 rounds of acid, I didn't have any cluster headaches for an entire year. I was so happy I cried. At first, I attributed it to the weather. San Francisco didn't have the brutal winters of NYC that seemed to intensify the pain of my headaches. I began hating my job in San Francisco. I do not work well for other people. I resented that I was not supported. I was more or less being forced into a marketing role, despite the fact that I had been hired as an intern, with promises of being trained. At this point, Anna and I were splitting rent. Despite the fact that she was pulling $180K a year from her tech job, she insisted on splitting expenses. I would anxiously budget every month, making sure I had enough money set aside for rent, my phone, and food. Anna was dating a cutie named Kay. They met on OkCupid before I moved to SF, and we clicked once we met in person. They were working as a pro dom at an infamous dungeon in Berkeley and were trying to break into kink.com. Anna would host brunches in the backyard of the home where we rented a room. I would pick loquats from the tree in the backyard, cook them with sugar and turn them into a sauce, serve it over pancakes or crepes, scramble some eggs. Kay would come over and I would sit on their lap. They would tell me about their work and the juicy gossip, the most perverted thing they had to do that week, some new skill they picked up. I was riveted. They knew I hated my job and suggested I try out sex work. I said I would think about it. I mentioned to Anna that I was going to try posting an ad on Seeking Arrangements. She bristled. I was confused and upset. Weren't we in an open relationship? She told me she felt that sex work was misleading, that my clientele would think they were actually in a relationship with me, and that made her uncomfortable. Then she said she would worry about my safety. I told her I was miserable, hated my job, and wanted to make more money. Sex work felt like my best option. The next time we visited our couple's therapist, I mentioned to her that I was considering sex work. Her face lit up, and she suggested several books on the topic for me to check out, as well as a few local advocacy groups. I devoured the books and did a bunch of internet research to make sure I knew everything I could about the topic. The pro dom I was dating also very sweetly took the time to let me bounce ideas off of them. I created my Seeking Arrangements profile that week.